Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. To Die of Hope. That's the title of an ecumenical prayer service in memory of the thousands of people who disappear in search of a better life. We hear the inspiring story of a pilot who has saved hundreds of so-called Cuban rafters in their journey of hope towards the shores of Florida. And Father Jim Brand reflects on the worth and on the dignity of workers. Another small paragraph in the paper today told of 10 bodies found in the waters just south of Sicily. Would-be refugees who met their death during their voyage of hope on an overcrowded and unseaworthy vessel. It was the second such news item I came across just this week. The victims were given no identities. It just said, 3 children, 2 women, 5 men. Soon to be forgotten, never to be named. Just extra numbers on an endless list of people who are no more. This week we celebrated World Refugee Day, with a thought for those who live in difficulty and hope far from their land and their loved ones. And today, in the Church of Santa Maria in Trastevere, an ecumenical prayer service is to take place in memory of the many who never made it.
For 10 years, more than 10 years, we in the community of Sant'Egidio have started to collect news about people who died mainly in the Mediterranean Sea.
Cecilia Pani is a member of the Sant'Egidio community, a movement of lay people dedicated to evangelization and charity. She's in charge of refugees and migrants.
Because we were struck about so many people dying and nobody could know anything about their story, their names. On the newspapers mainly was only about people coming to Italy like it was an invasion, a problem for southern Italy. And that's why we started to collect names and stories. And now we decided to do something in this occasion for the World Day of Refugee, to pray, to remember people who have disappeared, yes, and nobody can remember their names.
Now we're talking about men, women, children.
Yes, also babies. Families, entire families we have disappeared in the water, and most of them come from Africa, but also from Asia, from Turkey, from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from China.
It's for these people that the community of Sant'Egidio, together with the Italian branch of the Jesuit Refugee Service, the Federation of Evangelical Churches in Italy, the Migrantes Foundation, and the National Caritas Organization, has organized the prayer service entitled Morire di Speranza, to die of hope.
Who are these people? What would you like to say about these people so that we don't forget them?
They flew from their countries. Most of them are, refugees. They wanted to ask for asylum, but there are also people who escaped their country because of natural disasters. His Holiness Pope Paul VI called them economical refugees, a sort of people who escaped their country not only because of political problems, but because their land gave them no possibility to live.
You have met many of the ones who did make it, because a lot of them end up here at Sant'Egidio. What do they bring with them? What wealth do they have for us?
I think the ones who can reach our country are the strongest, also the most intelligent, the people who have already overcome a lot of problems and a lot of difficulties. That's why I say they are the strongest one, because you need money, you need courage, you need strength and good health to afford all this trip. In the last 10 years, I must say, in Italy we have less refugees, less people from Africa because of political choices. I'm talking about more difficulties in getting visas, and in general Europe has already closed its borders. But the ones who come really make us open our mentality, our eyes on the future, the real future of the world. That's why it's very important for us, for Europeans, not to get older as an old continent, but understand that our future is only with other people, and in particular people coming from Africa, because really the future of Europe is Africa. As long as the future of Africa is with Europe. I'm talking about the global aging of European population and the need we have of young people working. And also I'm talking about cultural awareness. Of course, Europe is a continent with a long history of culture, of important events, but now in the globalized world we can only go on if we don't close our borders.
These people, when they set out on their journeys, are they aware of the dangers that they are about to face? Do they know that they might lose their lives in the journey?
Yes, they do. Absolutely. And moreover, they pay a lot of money to do this. We can understand how desperate they are if we think that they try this terrible trip aware of all the dangers. And we know this because we met a lot of people who told us the history of their trip. Some of them have traveled for months on foot, by ship, and then in cars, in trains, by plane too, some of them.
Cecilia told me that general attention was catalysed in 1999 when two young boys from Guinea-Conakry hid in the belly of an aeroplane in a tragic attempt to reach Europe. She remembers their names.
Yagin Kouita and Fode Tonkara. They wanted to go to Europe to study, because in their country they couldn't go to school. Their bodies were discovered in Brussels many days later.
Let's remember these two boys, if you said their names, but like them there are thousands of others.
I think we can do something to avoid this. I think we can, in Europe, we can work to help Africa in many ways, economically and politically. But this is not enough. I think there is place for these people coming to Europe. We need them. And instead of being scared of invasions, it would be better to avoid such deaths and to help them to cross the border in a more secure way, because the danger is not for us, European, but it's for them, for their life.
I happen to meet someone who has an incredible life experience of saving desperate refugees from a watery death just recently here at the radio. Actually, she's the mother of one of our collaborators, Miami-born Vanessa Greco, who works on the news desk. She was here to see her daughter. Vanessa had already mentioned her mom and what she does to me, so when she came to the radio, I jumped at the chance of speaking to her personally.
My name is Maite Greco. I was born in Cuba, and I came to the United States when I was 2 years old. My parents were very young, and it was at the time Castro had taken over. And they thought, let's go to the United States because everybody's going over there, and wait and see what happens, because I thank God every day that my dad had a little vision that maybe things wouldn't work out that great.
So you didn't go as a refugee?
When we left, they had some flights. And what Castro did was, you know, people that want to leave the country can. And he's done that over time. what happened was his real opposition said, okay, let's go to the United States. The only drawback was that you had to leave everything behind, just what you were wearing.
Maite told me that she grew up in Florida, where just 90 miles of shark-infested water separated her from a large family of Cuban relatives, family that to this day she has never met. But she said she grew up with a dream.
Since I was a little kid, I wanted to fly airplanes. Nobody in my family is a pilot. And coming from a Latin family, that's not something that you want your daughter to become. My mom, still to this day, she says like, oh, you know, she wants to be a school teacher. But I blame it on them because I say when I was very little, as far as I remember, you know, we come as immigrants. We didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have air conditioning. So my dad at night, he would take us for little rides in the car. And one of the places we go, either to the beach, get the ocean breeze, or to the airport, because it was out in the middle of nowhere, and it was beautiful. It was quiet, and the lights, and there's, you know, people love to go see the airplanes take off and land. So I was fascinated, and I don't remember how old I was, you know, maybe four or five. All I remember are the little blue lights, and as I grew, I always loved the lights, and I always said, you know, as soon as I can, I want to learn how to fly. I was kept telling my parents that. They didn't think it was real. So the day I got my driver's license at 16, my parents said, you don't have to go to school. We'll go get your driver's license. And I said, great. And then, you know, they let me have the car. And what I did was I drove to the airport and I signed up for flying lessons.
And flying was to prove a lifelong passion. Maite told me that quite by chance, not long after she had got her flying license, she met a pilot named Jose Basulto.
We became friends right away. And we would fly. He had an airplane, and he would take me flying with him. And I loved it because, it, you know, he was very knowledgeable. He was very experienced and everything. This gentleman, actually, he was a veteran of the Bay of Pigs. In any case, that's where he got his training and things, and he loved to fly, too. He tells me one day, I'm with him, and he says, you know, I have a friend. His name is Billy Shoes. And you know what he does? He loves boating, but what he does is he goes out on his boat, and he looks for Cuban rafters. Now, a Cuban rafter is a person that actually gets really, literally on an inner tube. That's the classic. They study the currents a little bit. Right. And the summer currents, if you jump on it and float, it should bring you to the shores of the United States, close to the southern tip of Florida. Mm-hmm. So he says, you know, on a boat, your vision is just a straight line, and a boat goes very slow. How about if we go on the airplane next time that he goes out, and we'll circle him over the air, and we'll see if we see anybody? So we started doing that.
And that was to be the beginning of a mission destined to grow and grow. Although, Maite said, it took quite a while before they actually started to sight rafters.
And did you immediately start sighting rafters?
No, because we didn't know how to look for them, first of all. Right. We were flying about 1,000 feet for safety. We're in a single-engine little Cessna. If you lose your engine, you're in the middle of the ocean. At 1,000 feet, you can't talk to anybody. There's no communication. You're on your own. So actually, we did the first day. The next time we went, we actually wore life jackets. We said, you know what? We fall at 1,000 feet. We don't have time to put life jackets. We started wearing our life jackets on. All right. And then we started taking a raft with us because it's like, oh, great. The plane will sink and we'll be like little dots. Because we realized as we're seeing the crew, the boats, you know, all the fishermen, they're in very big yachts. And we realized these big yachts look like little dots in the water, very small. So we said, well, if we're going to spot a raft, which is a very tiny thing, we have to start flying very low. So now we're flying very low. So, you know, precautions, we start taking flares because we realize, you know, if we go down, and it's something a pilot does when you're on a single engine airplane, you always think, if my engine goes away, what do I do? You know, you land it. So we're at the airport now, and we start leaving frequently. People see us leaving with our life jackets on and the flares, and then people say, like, where are you going? Why are you wearing your life jackets? Like, oh, we're going to do this. So then some flight instructors say, like, hey, can we sit in the back seat? Because, that you know, you pilots get experience sitting in the back seat. Now we're flying low over the water, something different. how cool, can I bring my camera or whatever? So now we get like people that want to come with us. Now we have a lot of people want to come with us. And now we have a waiting list. And then the next thing, some of the instructors are saying, well, you know, they're building up hours always. Right. How about if we take students and build up hours like that? So now we're going like two airplanes at the same time. And it's like, great, because if something happens to me, I have another airplane. Well, the next thing you know, then we have four airplanes. And we're now like a really organized group, and we have found no rafts.
It was at this point that José Basulto, Maite Greco, and their companions founded a non-profit organization they called Brothers to the Rescue. All those who participated did so on a voluntary basis.
The first day that we went out as that group and we're actually on the radio doing something, somebody spotted our first real raft. And because we were trying to get funds, we had media with us. We had camera people with us. And a boat spotted one. And we're like, six airplanes out there in one helicopter. Everybody's so excited. We want to go see what it looks like. And on my way to find it, I found a raft. And that was my first one.
Without anyone on it?
Just no, a raft. This one had people on it.
You found a raft with
people? I found a raft with people. It actually was a canoe. Mm-hmm. And it had three people on it. And I, you know, since, remember, we don't know exactly what we're looking for here. I come down, we're in the middle of the ocean. And, oh yes, that's small. We're 500 feet for safety. And the camera guys start looking with the lens. They're like, oh yeah, they have no paddles. It's three guys looks on the boat. So we come into a very little low pass over it. And the man, he puts his hands over the two other, it was their sons. And then the next time we come to do another pass, he stands up and waves. And then you can see there's happiness in him. He's in the middle of the ocean. He'd been floating for 4 days. They have no food or water. His sons are all blistered up, pretty burned up from the sun. And, well, we keep circling him. We think we know what we're going to do when we find her off. We're going to circle because we can't land on the water. And then we've coordinated with the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard said, we'll pick them up.
The Miami Coast Guard.
Yes. Actually, they're based out of Key West. Mm-hmm. And they would be the ones to come. They come via helicopter, a Coast Guard mm-hmm. cutter, mm-hmm. and they would pick them up. So as we're circling this raft, I'm always going to the left because that's how I see, in very steep turns over a small point in circle. My cameraman, when you look for a camera lens, and these are things we learned through the years, like we tell the camera people, don't look through your lens only when you have to because you get very dizzy, you may get mm-hmm. sick. Oh, okay. One of the cameramen said, turn the other way. I don't feel so good. Turn the other way. As we turn the other way, we actually spot an inner tube with one young boy in it. He's 15 years old. And he's waving. Now, this is our first day we find these people. So, of course, we go where the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard took them to Key West. We landed
so
in Key West.
So the Coast Guard.
Picked them up.
Did you wait for the Coast Guard?
Oh, absolutely.
You wait.
Absolutely. Because they're so small. Mm-hmm. The Coast Guard would bring them to the United States, and because it's a communist country, they would be given political asylum right away. Mm-hmm. That changed when the Carter administration took over. And it changed to the point where if we found a raft and we called the Coast Guard, they would be taken back to Cuba. They would be taken to a holding facility, and technically they would be taken back. Now, a lot of them were processed, and if they had families and sponsors and things, they were given an opportunity to come to the United States, but it was very slim.
Did you have any idea of how many people tried to raft across?
Oh, well, we had some statistics from the Coast Guard, and actually we did a lot of work doing that because as the years went by and the time went by, we would found the empty rafts. And pretty much the statistic says that out of every four vessels, it doesn't matter if it's an inner tube, a canoe, or a boat, only one will make it.
So out of four
people,
one makes it.
One person makes it.
How many people try to leave Cuba?
Thousands. Because we found thousands. I think personally I found over 300 in, a few years span.
Between 1991 and 1996, the year in which Cuban MiGs shot down two of their planes, killing four pilots, Brothers to the Rescue conducted over 2,400 aerial search missions. These operations resulted in the rescue of more than 4,200 men, women and children, and in the rescue of thousands of others during the refugee crisis of 1994. In fact, reading on the internet, I discovered that it has been estimated that Brothers to the Rescue pilots have saved one life for every 2 hours of flight time. This is considered a record rate among professional search and rescue organizations.
I could go on for hours telling you of all the different things that I saw. We saw people getting eaten by a shark because we couldn't save them in time because their inner tubes were sinking, and you know, one would come off and that one was gone, and you know, and you have a brother losing a brother, and that's, I witnessed that situation and it was horrible. We would also drop supplies to them. One time we found a raft, and we would drop always water, a little sign, you know, welcome to the U.S., you're free. Yeah, something cute, a radio to find out their conditions. I mean, we got sophisticated over the years. But one time we dropped a bottle of water, and the water didn't land right on the raft, so they were so desperate. The youngest one on the boat, they were very ill on the boat already, he jumped out to get it. And when he jumped out, because they had one dead body on the raft, they couldn't let go of it. It was a family member. They did have the sharks around it. This little boy, he was swimming towards the water, and the shark was coming at him. So we started going down with the plane very low to see if the noise of the airplane would distract, but we're getting dangerously low to see if it would distract and throwing other things. He made it back onto the raft, and the Coast Guard that day was really close by with a helicopter, so they were airlifted right away. But the body, before the helicopter came, ended up falling in the water and they
disappeared.
Right, that's it. We saw things in the air, we saw things in the ocean, animals, creatures, and obviously the people. And what I was saying was, people came to build up ours, and when you save a life for the first time, you realize, like, oh my goodness, you know, I am hooked, I have to keep doing this. And sometimes we would fly and not find anybody on that day, because that would happen, and we say, if we had only one more hour, we can search a little bit more, or we find a lot, well, there's maybe more out there. It became really something that became part of our lives and who we were, the work that we were all doing. We're still a very close group. We've ceased to operate as a group, as an operation, but we became a very big family of hundreds of pilots that we were there. We're still very close because the things we witnessed were so amazing.
And now, Father Jim Brand, spiritual director at the Pontifical Beda College, reflects on the worth and on the dignity of workers.
Hello, it's Father Jim again. I'm making noises about the Holy Spirit, which is what, shall we say, made our Lord tick. And he ended his life by saying, "I have finished the work I have been given to do." So I'd like to pause a moment to make gratitude noises to those who work. Some work with their hands, which is so dignified. Some earn their living with their mind. Lawyers, the studies they have to do and the exams they have to pass, although they might charge a lot, at least they've had to work and also continue being up to date. I'm thinking of dentists, artists, labourers who make the world go round by using their gift and talent. And judging by some people's wages, they're not often thanked. In particular, I'm thinking of people who are treated as servile or slaves. Nowadays, people go to supermarkets and buy oranges. They don't think of the people, often paid very little, who've been brought in to pick the oranges. They're called illegal immigrants, some of them, in the United States. And I gather that some of them are going to be made legal. I'm thrilled about that. Fruit collecting is very labour-intensive. So I'm thinking of all those who labour with the work of their hands or their heart or their mind. And this is a little tribute of gratitude. And I'm also thinking of those who would love to work. But there's no room for them in the marketplace, it seems. I hope you don't mind my sharing poetry. I often think even if what I say is rubbish, at least it will give you a chance to hear somebody else's great work of art. And this is a little poem called The Village Blacksmith by this great American poet I quoted last week, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The Village Blacksmith. And this poem tells me about being needed, especially in the days of horses, and appreciation by the local community, and how, although he's been widowed, he quietly gets on with his dignified work for the community. The Village Blacksmith. Under a spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands. The smith, a mighty man is he, with large and sinewy hands, and the muscles of his brawny arms are strong as iron bands. His hair is crisp and black and long. His face is like the tan. His brow is wet with honest sweat. He earns whate'er he can and looks the whole world in the face, for he owes not any man. Week in, week out, from morn till night, you can hear his bellows blow. You can hear him swing his heavy sledge with measured beat and slow, like a sexton ringing the village bell when the evening sun is low. And children coming home from school look in at the open door. They love to see the flaming forge and hear the bellows roar, and catch the burning sparks that fly like chaff from a threshing floor. He goes on Sunday to the church and sits among the boys. He hears the parson pray and preach. He hears his daughter's voice singing in the village choir. It makes his heart to rejoice. It sounds to him like her mother's voice singing in paradise. He needs must think of her once more, how in the grave she lies. And with his hard, rough hand, he wipes a tear out of his eyes. Toiling, rejoicing, sorrowing, onward through life he goes. Each morning sees some task begin, each evening sees it close. Something attempted, something done, has earned a night's repose. Thanks. Thanks to thee, my worthy friend, for the lesson thou hast taught. Thus at the flaming forge of life, our fortunes must be wrought. Thus on its sounding anvil shaped, each burning deed and thought. Oh, I think that's beautiful. Toiling, rejoicing, sorrowing. The Holy Spirit is there in our work, in our sorrows, and in our joys, and in those, like his wife, who've gone before us. Amen.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.